Bank Treasuries go pond fishing. Dear Bank Treasury subscribers, June is an excellent time to get away from the office and go pond fishing. Everyone in the Bank Treasury world seems to take vacation around this time, so feel free to disconnect and step back because even Bank Treasurers who work all the time occasionally need a vacation. Besides, the Fed just told us that rate cuts are on hold until after the summer, if not until next year, which means that the fixed income markets will still be in a range-bound holding pattern waiting for you when you return. Pond fishing is a very peaceful summer pastime. After all, once you dunk hook, line, and sinker in the water, there is nothing to do but sit around and wait for the fish to bite. So prepare to wait a long time because the fish are not stupid and they know how to deal with baited hooks, which gives bank treasurers plenty of time to think about the big picture they see as they head into the second half of this year. And their picture is very big and complicated, so they will need the time to sort it through, at least as a whole newsletter's worth. Big pictures are like the forest and the trees. The forest can get lost in the trees, but without the trees, you cannot see the forest. Details matter, but they're easy to get confused. The economic landscape is an excellent example of how making sense of the forest and the trees can be challenging. Thus, while the data-dependent voting members of the FOMC are predisposed to ease monetary policy and all they need is for the economy to give them a good reason to do so, that reason has proved elusive. There is no shortage of economic pundits in and out of the Fed who believe that the good reason is staring them right in the face, that the economy is already flashing warning signs. Still, unfortunately, as usual, given their backward-facing position, the FOMC will only see the missed signals in hindsight. But there is also the argument that this time is different. Thus, the big picture might be that inflation is slowing this year, with the Fed's preferred gauge, the Consumer Purchase Expenditures Index, down to 2.7% in April 2024. The PC index was 5% in September 2022, so the latest April 2024 reading is an improvement. But hold on, the index is higher now than in January and February 2024, when it equaled 2.5%, and higher than in December 2023 at 2.6%. Moreover, excluding food and energy, the PC index stands at 2.9% in decimal places aside. 2.5, 2.6, 2.7, and 2.9% still do not round down to 2%, the Fed's long-run target for this inflation statistic. The other part of the economic picture is that while inflation is improving, albeit slowly and unevenly, the economy remains surprisingly robust. Non-farm payrolls in May 2024 climbed by 272,000 full-time jobs. The first rate hike by the Fed was in March 2022, and since then, the Fed's restrictive monetary policy aside, NFPs have averaged 298,000 a month. To put this number into perspective, from December 2015 to December 2018, during the previous rate hiking cycle, the average monthly NFP was 189,000. Since July 2023, after the Fed's last rate hike in this cycle, monthly NFPs averaged 208,000. Job creation during this rate hiking cycle, based on nominal numbers, is the strongest in decades. Inflation and NFP statistics do not tell the whole story about the economy, which may still be defying gravity, or finally succumbing to the pressure of the Fed's restrictive monetary policy, depending on the latest retail sales, industrial production, housing construction, confidence survey, or GDP number that comes out. But with no consistent trend of the data that matters, the big picture is the bottom line, which is that there are no rate cuts in the picture, no matter how expansive the horizon is. Oh sure, someday, one day, probably by year end, but that is no longer certain. The Fed will cut. The chairman, president, and chief executive officer of a large regional bank in the Southeast, speaking before the FOMC's release, told analysts this month that he was bearish on any cuts this year. "I think that if we get one cut this year, I'll be surprised. And there's a good chance that we don't get any cuts this year, given the overall stickiness that we're seeing with inflation. 2 days from now, we'll know more, because the picture is unclear. And the FOMC needs a clear picture showing progress on inflation getting back to its long-term 2% target," as he continued to explain. "I think they've been very direct about it. They need to see sustainable progress that we're approaching that 2% target. And I don't know whether you measure that in months or quarters. They seem to be talking about months at this time. But I think you've got to see that over the next 2 or 3 or 4 months. And then I think you'll see the Fed cut rates." But why should the Fed cut rates? Who wants that? This question is of particular interest to bank treasurers with a big pile of cash earning overnight interest on reserve deposits at the Fed at 5.4%, a risk-free overnight rate that also happens to be the highest point on the yield curve. 5.4% risk-free. Getting paid 5.4% overnight risk-free is not too bad in the big picture scheme of things, considering all the interest rate, credit, and liquidity risks bank treasurers usually need to take to generate interest income. According to the Fed's HIP4 report, commercial banks held $3.4 trillion in reserve deposits at the Fed, 15% of their total deposits, which means that over the last year, using the proverbial back of the envelope, bank treasuries have earned interest income totaling $190 billion courtesy of the Fed. Risk-free overnight interest income of that size is a gift. To put this number into context, the FDIC reported last month that the banking industry earned $1.2 trillion of interest income in the previous four fiscal quarters from Q2 2023 to Q1 2024, so 16% was generated risk-free courtesy of the Fed's monetary policy. Even better, Fed's main message to the markets, at least as far as bank treasury sitting on cash are concerned, is to let the good times roll. So why complain? CFO of a large regional bank on the East Coast was not just sitting on a lot of cash at the Fed. His earning assets, including his bond and loan portfolio, were concentrated in the front end of the yield curve too, which is excellent provided the rates stay at these levels long enough to reprice his assets before the Fed ultimately cuts. As he told analysts, "We're among our peers, our duration, no reveal here, is shorter. We're at the front end of the line in terms of being able to reprice. Everyone will be able to reprice their fixed rate assets, but if we're not maturing, you gotta wait for that to happen by the invisible light of our star." Charting the economic train before them, the voting members of the FOMC steer their course led by an unobservable R-star, hypothetical neutral overnight interest rate where the economy is at full employment and price inflation is stable. With R-star to guide them, they still believe that their present monetary policy is economically restrictive enough, even though to date, a 5.25-5.5% target range for the Fed funds rate and its program of balance sheet reduction through QT has failed to contain inflation, much less have cooled off employment. Even if their current policy is restrictive, how restrictive is unclear as models differ. Perhaps it is not restrictive enough. But for now, they are not asking that question. When asked whether the FOMC could vote for another hike, Chairman Powell said he was confident that the Fed funds rate did not need to go higher, at least not in his base case. As he told the press this month when asked about the possibility of another rate hike, not to eliminate the possibility of hikes, but you know, no one has that as their base case. No one on the committee does. Even if its next move was to hike, it is unlikely that it would be a sudden decision, judging how the Fed was so slow to move against inflation in 2021, which may have led to the rate environment we're in today. If it had moved sooner to raise rates, the argument goes, the Fed may not have needed to go as high as and as fast as it did. But even hindsight has its limits on shedding light on the past, and we might still have ended up with an effective Fed funds rate holding above 5.3%. Regardless, most bank treasurers believed without question that FOMC officials would give them plenty of warning if they were about to reverse course and seriously consider the possibility of raising rates at this point. Voters would be giving speeches and putting out plenty of forward guidance before they would raise rates. As the above-quoted chairman, president, and CEO of a large regional bank in the Southeast said, the Fed would not surprise the market with a sudden hike in rates. Not now. I would say it's not off the table in my view, but I think it's rather unlikely that the next move is an increase. I think you will have a whole lot of forecasting and verbal communication before that becomes a real possibility. We'll get a new dot plot this week, which in some ways is useful, but it also answers just one of the two of the questions, not all of them. I'm in the camp that you wouldn't get a rate increase without a whole lot more clarity from the Fed. So, no bank treasurer is seriously worried about a sudden drop in rates, although losing all that risk-free interest income going back to a normal yield curve where they must use judgment about term structure, decide where the best place on the yield curve would be to price assets and deposits, and work a little harder to generate NII will hurt a little bit. But how big a deal is lower rates for banks? Rising rates have caused bank failures, but banks do not generally fail when rates are falling, at least not suddenly, as few of them did last year because the Fed raised rates. High rates have not dented employment yet, but the Fed's monetary policy has been plenty restrictive on the housing industry, where the first-time homebuyers can barely afford a mortgage, let alone find a house to buy with it. Existing homeowners, especially those who signed their mortgage contracts before 2022, when mortgage rates had two handles on them instead of seven handles, are staying put in their homes and holding off for downsizing. This is reducing the supply of homes and helping to push home values to new heights, at least on paper. And so, despite a robust employment picture, according to a government website, there is a homeless crisis in this country that is getting worse. Between 40 to 60% of the people without a home may have a job but cannot afford shelter, much less food, because of the cost of housing, which has grown faster than their wages. A matter of political perspective and credibility. This is where politicians enter the picture, clouding what should be a purely independent decision by the FOMC about setting a benchmark interest rate based on what is best for the long-term optimal health of the economy. There is the upcoming presidential election to consider, and many bank treasurers subscribe to the theory that the Fed would not cut or hike the Fed funds rate right before an election, although notably, next-to-last FOMC meeting of the year begins on November 6th, the day after the national election. The Fed does not want to appear by its actions to favor any political party as a matter of policy, but even doing nothing is doing something, at least in the political big picture of which the Fed is a part. The Fed's policy is about more than economics. It is a campaign slogan, as this letter from Senators Elizabeth Warren, John Hickenlooper, Sheldon Whitehouse, and Jackie Rosen attest. Dear Chair Powell, they wrote, we write today to urge the Federal Reserve, the Fed, to cut the Fed funds rate from its current two decades high of 5.5%. This sustained period of high interest rates is already slowing the economy, is failing to address the remaining key drivers of inflation. Furthermore, the European Central Bank, which like the Fed has a mandate to steer inflation towards a target of 2%, cut interest rates for the first time in 5 years. It's time for the Fed to do the same. Of course, the senators undoubtedly know that there are different central banks for a reason. What works in one country may not be appropriate in another. The fact is that inflation is falling faster in the European Union than in the U.S., even if the progress on that front seems as if it has stalled out this year. Also, arguing that the largest and most important central bank in the world should take its cue from another central bank sounds almost insulting. But leaving these quibbles aside, when the ECB cut its benchmark rate by 25 basis points this month, it also raised its forecast for inflation in 2024, justifying its rate cut based on its forecast that inflation would get back in line with the bank's 2% goal by next year. However, if a central bank has any real power over the financial markets, its decisions must be credible and consistent. If you say, as the Fed has said, that it will remain skeptical that inflation is getting back to its 2% long-term goal and bias in favor of holding rates at a restrictive level until there is evidence persuading you otherwise, you cannot suddenly turn around and cut rates when the inflation numbers round out to 3%, much less cut them when you expect inflation, at least in the short term, to still increase, not without losing credibility. And it's not clear that the ECB's decision was anything other than a political statement, if for no other reason than both the Fed and the Bank of England this month held fast to their restrictive policies. Whether the Fed's monetary policy is effective enough is an open question. FOMC officials generally speak of a lag effect, though without defining a timeline, when lag is no longer an excuse for ineffectiveness. But the senators make an interesting observation that mortgage rates and auto insurance premiums are contributing to inflation, the former which, if it were lower, would help reduce inflation, the latter which is not directly connected to economic imbalances between supply and demand and thus not determined by interest rate levels. Lowering interest rates to reduce inflation almost sounds counterintuitive, as they conceded in their letter, since the point of higher rates is to curb credit creation by banks to slow an overheating economy, which high inflation is supposed to be a symptom. If higher rates do dampen home buying to reduce auto purchases because debtors cannot afford the interest payments, this is the cost of monetary policy to control prices, notwithstanding the merits of their complaint to Chair Powell. There is an awkward but inescapable fact that the only interest rate that the Fed can directly control is the overnight rate, not the 10-year rate, nor mortgage rates, to which they are tied. Mortgage rates are the highest they have been in more than two decades, but so is the yield on the 10-year Treasury. Even at 4.2%, which is 120 basis points below the overnight rate that the Fed pays banks for their reserve deposits, the rate of the 10-year Treasury is still higher than it was more than 20 years ago. Thus, if the senators really wanted to help first-time homebuyers afford a mortgage, they should write a letter to whoever controls forward rates to get them to make the yield curve even more inverted than it already is. Soma's impact. And since the rate in question that the senators want to cut are mortgage rates and not the overnight rate, there is little the Fed can do to bring down the former other than to, say, ramp up its investment agency MBS and its Soma portfolio. Perhaps the Fed could help bring down mortgage rates by buying a massive amount of agency MBS at this point. Unfortunately, for the past 2 years, the Fed has been trying to shrink, not grow, its investment in the asset class. Thanks to the fact that the Fed bought most of this portfolio when rates had two handles and not seven handles on them, after 2 years of QT, most of what it purchased during QE is still on its balance sheet. While it's not trying to sell its $2.4 trillion portfolio of agency MBS outright, which likely could push mortgage rates higher, the Fed began this month to take the principal cash flows from the portfolio and reinvest them in treasuries. The bottom line is that the Fed is not trying to support the residential mortgage market, however much the senators wish it would do. This is not to gainsay the size of the Soma portfolio, which at $6.8 trillion, including $4.5 trillion of treasuries and $2.4 trillion of agency MBS, eclipses the banking industry's aggregate investment portfolio, which the latest H8 data put at $4.2 trillion, including $2.5 trillion in agency MBS and $1.6 trillion in treasuries. And Soma is large relative to outstandings. According to the U.S. Treasury, there are $27 trillion of marketable treasuries outstanding, of which $6 trillion were originally issued as T-bills, $5 trillion were originally issued as 20 and 30-year T-bonds, and the rest were issued as T-notes ranging in maturity from 2 to 10 years. However, QT on paper does not seem like it should have much of an impact on the Treasury or agency MBS markets in terms of trading volumes or new issuance. Trading volume in Treasury coupons averaged $616 billion a month over the last 12 months, which compares to the Treasuries the Fed holds in its summer portfolio, which have been running off at an average rate of $54 billion per month. Treasury net issuance in 2023 equaled $3 trillion, of which Treasury coupons accounted for $0.4 trillion. QT should have even less of an impact on trading markets with the Fed's new $30 billion QT cap on treasuries in place starting this month. The Treasury's monthly average net issuance, excluding T-bills, was $59 billion, including T-bills, which mostly went to feed the money market funds, were using them to replace their investment in the Fed's RRP, and which also went to meet additional demand by private investors on TreasuryDirect.gov. Average monthly net issuance over the last year was $207 billion. According to a recent study, a third of the Treasury securities outstanding come due within a year, given the high proportion of T-bills that are outstanding in the Treasury. However, the runoff of T-bills from the Fed's $0.2 trillion investment it holds in SOMA, a level which is probably going to remain stable when the Fed ultimately ends QT, hardly seems like it should be much of a factor in the pricing of T-bills. Similarly, the Fed's investment agency MBS requires some putting in context. At year-end 2021, according to the latest available estimate by SIFMA, agency MBS outstanding equaled over $9 trillion, a figure that most likely increased even if mortgage loan origination volume is down by two-thirds from the peak in 2020, and not much better this year. In the last 12 months, SIFMA reports that the average monthly issuance in agency MBS, including CMOs, has been $111 billion, while trading volumes have averaged $271 billion. Meanwhile, principal cash flow from the Fed's agency MBS portfolio averaged $17 billion over the last year. Shrinking reserve deposits after RRP. Theoretically, the purpose of QT is to shrink the supply of liquidity in the financial markets, thus tightening trading conditions and raising the overall level of interest rates. Before the global financial crisis, the Fed used to regulate the supply of reserves, keeping them tight enough to control the effective Fed funds rate. But of course, after December 2008, the Fed changed the rules and not only flooded the financial system with excess reserves, but time and again has reaffirmed its commitment to maintain a level of reserves far beyond what banks require to manage payments, to hold as a source of liquidity, or to earn risk-free interest income. With the balance of reserves at $3.4 trillion, more than twice as much as existed in the system in March 2020, regardless of how the Fed describes the level of reserves as ample or abundant, it still has no direct way of determining an overnight rate by regulating reserve balances. Instead, it controls the effective Fed funds rate with the IORB and the RRP. The IORB is set at 5.4%, which is 10 basis points below the top of the target range for the effective Fed funds rate, and the RRP, which is set at 5.3%, which is 5 basis points above the bottom of the range. With these two rates providing a ceiling and a floor, the effective Fed funds rate held steady at 5.33% since the Fed's last rate hike in July 2023. But with the balance of the RRP now under $0.4 trillion, bank treasurers are thinking a lot about what happens now with QT and whether reserves, which have basically stayed flat even while the Fed shaved off $1.7 trillion from its balance sheet, will start to shrink. The good news, if they are worrying about it, is that the Fed is tapering QT, and presumably soon it will stop shrinking its balance sheet altogether and still leave the financial system swimming in more liquidity than it was 4 years ago. But it is understandable why they may be worried. Bank deposits remained relatively stable thanks to the fact that over the last 2 years, the Fed has used the RRP and not reserve balances for the runoff from SOMA. Connected or not, according to H8 data since June 2022, commercial bank deposits fell by a grand total of only $364 billion, down 2% from $17.9 trillion. The CFO of a large regional bank in the Northeast told analysts, "The RRP has been a shock absorber for QT for several quarters, and we suspect that the RRP in the coming quarters will not be as much of a shock absorber as it's been. If the Fed keeps its foot on the pedal with QT, it may have an impact on deposit levels across the system." The CFO of a large regional bank in the Midwest was worried because if what above-quoted CFO said happens and the Fed does not stop QT soon, even with the Treasury cap cut from $60 billion a month to $30 billion, reserve balances may fall too far and leave the market vulnerable to another disruption, as happened in the repo market in September 2019. The RRP is one that we've been paying a lot of attention to. We think they're at their floor right now, and we're not expecting them to go to zero. It's very clear when you look at the Fed balance sheet data, when you look at reserves, that the RRP has absorbed a lot of the reduction in market liquidity. So that is something that we're cautious about if for some reason we see funding pressures out of bank deposits or challenges where some folks might start getting short on reserves. The RRP saved banks from seeing more deposit outflows last year than they had expected, explained the CFO of a large global bank. Last year, we thought our deposit levels would go down 8 to 10% given the regional bank crisis, the geopolitics, and the debt ceiling. But we were a little better to the upside. We expected to grind lower this year as well, but in Q1, we didn't really see that happen. It came out of the RRP. Inverted existential peril. The yield curve is another part of the picture bank treasurers struggle to understand, and as Alan Greenspan noted, the longer end of the yield curve can be a conundrum. However, Chairman Greenspan never saw this picture of a yield curve as it exists today, where the negative spread between the 3-month and the 5-year treasuries has averaged more than 100 basis points since October 2022. However, the spread has also been volatile, swinging back and forth by 30 to 40 basis points, depending on the market's views on the prospect for rate cuts, trading as data-dependent as the Fed. Interest rate scenarios, such as those published by the OCC semi-annually since October 2020, focus on parallel shocks where the front end and the belly of the yield curve and the long end all move up or down simultaneously. But interest rates can move in more complicated directions. The yield curve could both flatten, where the back end falls faster than the front end when the Fed cuts rates because the market anticipates even further cuts by the Fed on the front end. Yield curve shape projection is hard to predict, but the ideal interest rate scenario, as far as bank treasurers are concerned, is where the front end of the yield curve falls and the long end stays anchored, also known as a bull steepener. This scenario will return the yield curve to a standard shape where depositors can earn higher interest rates for longer than shorter terms, the opposite of what prevails today in deposit pricing. Higher for longer would be fine for bank NII and net interest margin, provided the yield curve returned to a typical positive slope. CFO of a large asset-sensitive regional bank in the Midwest told analysts that higher for longer, where the yield curve remains inverted, is good and bad for bank treasury. The range of interest rates that drive our business is the 3-month to the 5-year, the real belly of the curve, and what we're seeing is a higher for longer scenario. There are positives and there are some challenges. The biggest positives with respect to our NIM is that, as at this point, is the fixed asset repricing. Relative to the yields on loans that are paying down versus the newly originated loans in that category, we're seeing between 250 and 300 basis points yield improvement. The challenge is the inverted yield curve. I've seen some statistics recently that depending on which yield curve metrics you look at is either 40 or 60 years since we've seen the yield curve as inverted as this. The CFO of a large regional bank based on the East Coast agreed. For us, an ideal would be a steep yield curve. Less ideal is an inverted or a more inverted yield curve. Bank treasurers need to think strategically because while the Fed may be saying it is probably not cutting rates this summer and possibly not all year, eventually it will be cutting the rates it pays on IORB and RRP. When it does, with any luck, the front end of the yield curve will fall and the back end will stay anchored or not fall by as much. The question is how to prepare for that eventuality because the inverted yield curve complicates the cost equation for hedging against lower rates. For one thing, you earn less nominal interest on a swap's receive fixed leg than your counterparty receiving a floating rate. That can turn into a lot of interest given up to locking yields on earning assets, especially if higher yields for longer are higher rates in an inverted yield curve forever and well into 2025. The CFO of a large regional bank explained how his bank was adjusting its hedging strategy using interest rate swaps to prepare for eventual rate cuts and potentially some flattening in the yield curve. Generally speaking, we're modestly asset sensitive. We've kept that position intentionally to capture the benefit of higher for longer rate environment, and that's worked quite well. As we go forward, we intend to gradually reduce our asset sensitivity, and that's already baked into the hedging and swap plan, gradually increasing received fixed swaps on a forward starting basis in the early to middle part of next year, and gradually allowing expiration of our pay fixed swaps in a similar time frame. Deposit strategies as the Fed stays on hold. As bank treasurers tell this newsletter, retail depositors do not pay much attention to forecasts on interest rate cuts. They are only interested in the highest rate they can earn, even if extending from a 3-month to a 12-month CD would cost them only a quarter point of yield give up. But as far as the CFO of a large regional bank in the Northeast was concerned, if the customer does not care and wants to stay short, even if that means paying the customer a higher interest rate, it will all work out in the end for bank treasurers, assuming the yield curve reverts to a positive slope. We have progressively moved our CD book to shorter duration. We're 5 or 6 months in duration. It's costing us a little bit more than if we were longer right now, but we're taking a longer-term view. We think eventually we'll have an upward-sloping yield curve that will benefit from that at some point down the road. Bank treasuries are shortening up their CD offers, according to the CFO of a large regional bank in the Southeast. This time last year, we were offering 11-month CD rates. Now we are looking at a much shorter term and a lower rate. The difference in rate between CD and money markets is getting much closer here. The closer we all get to that first rate cut, the duration's coming down on those rate offers. They have a lot of thinking to do about deposits and pricing in the coming months, even if the Fed stays on hold for the rest of the year, or even if the Fed cuts rates. One school of thought, for example, says that rate cuts could spur competitors to hike rates to grab market share. The CFO of a large regional bank in the Midwest explained how deposit rates could go up when the Fed cuts. Most of us would think deposits are out there to fund loans. So if there's no loan growth, there's probably less pressure on deposit rates. So it might feel counterintuitive that rates stay higher. But if we see a cut or two, loan demand picks up. So then you might not see betas move as quickly because we'll want to maintain the deposit funding. Balance sheet structure should play a role in deposit costs, as banks with an above-average ratio of loans to deposits theoretically tend to pay for their interest-bearing deposits more than banks with low loan-to-deposit ratios. However, Kohl Report data does not support this theory so well. For example, in Massachusetts, where the average LDR in the state was 95% in Q1 2024, the average cost of interest-bearing deposits in the quarter was 2.5%. In Texas, the average LDR was 68%, and the cost of interest-bearing deposits was 2.6%. Based on a simple national average, Figure 1, interest-bearing deposit costs are still climbing and not showing any signs of flattening out in line with the message to equity markets. Trying to get a big picture perspective on deposit pricing is not easy. According to the CFO of a regional bank in the Midwest, deposit pricing decisions depend on the market, the product, and the size of the bank. The main difference really is between the larger banks, the mid-sized banks, and then small banks and large credit unions. So large banks in general, we've seen them maintain a significant amount of discipline, especially in the consumer books. We've just not seen a lot of rate competition from them. Now, in the markets where larger banks get a little more aggressive, in wealth, say, as well as in the commercial portfolio, we will see more aggressive offers when they're basically trying to buy a relationship. You can make generalized comments like this about large banks, but smaller, mid-sized institutions are a little different. As he continued, mid-sized banks, it tends to be more company-specific. We are seeing folks that continue to have work from a funding perspective who are tending to be a little bit more aggressive, and those that are focused on just outright growth. And they're tending to be a little bit more aggressive. But it is really an institution by institution and market by market basis. But if you're looking for a signal that deposit pressures have stabilized, look no further than what has been going on with the smaller community banks, as he concluded. Probably the more interesting one recently has been, we've seen a bit of a pullback from smaller banks and credit unions. Last year, they were competitive, especially in the CD offers, and that's a spot where we've seen them come off a bit. But overall, broadly speaking, we continue to feel a decrease in competition relative to where we were late last year, and the trends have been stable for the past 5 to 6 months. The demand deposit account migration has also decelerated. The last 3 months of DDA migration have been the lowest that we've seen since the hiking cycle began. The CFO of a large regional bank based on the East Coast offered to sum up the entire deposit situation with one word. Deposits, the message is stable. Our non-interest-bearing deposit balances are higher than they were at quarter end. This is the first time I've seen them go up like this. That tells me that at a minimum things have stabilized considerably. Deposits are stable, said the CFO of a large regional bank in the Midwest, which means that on the one hand, bank treasurers do not have to worry anymore about the risk of a deposit war, but also that there is not much opportunity to reduce rates yet. I think maybe the best way to describe it is stable. I would say we feel like there's less room for taking rates down. There's going to be ongoing competition around deposits. I don't think rates are spiking, but I don't think it's decreasing as much as people would have expected. But the effect of rate cuts on deposits is not the whole story. Even if pressure is easing for them on the right side of their balance sheet, the prospect of rate cuts could spur loan growth, which could intensify pressure on deposits, as the CFO of a large regional bank explained. We're seeing the deposit cost environments top out. We're seeing now the beginning stages of down beta management in the environment broadly. We're seeing shortening of CD offers, testing of lower price points in various customer segments and geographies. So that's occurring. And also, we're seeing loan growth across the industry stabilized. And I think it's poised to continue to modestly grow over the course of the remainder of this year, which is increasing the demand for deposit gathering across the sector, which is somewhat increasing competition. Borrowers cannot hold their breath forever. The loan picture still seems weak according to H8 data, which shows growth has been flat all year, growing by just 1% in the last 12 months. But borrowers may need to step up as bank treasurers theorize that they must be running out of their COVID stimulus cash and might be on the verge of capitulating and finally drawing down on their untapped credit lines. The CFO of a Northeast regional bank expected capitulation, that the loans were coming. It's just a matter of time. They've been strengthening balance sheets ever since the pandemic, and they've been managing their costs. The other input is that rates are still high. Inflation is still there. I think that as time passes, I think there will be some capitulation. At a large regional bank in the Midwest, the CFO also believed that borrowers were on the verge of capitulating. I think there's a big psychological effect from interest rates. The expectation is that rates are going to come down, and so people are willing to hold their breath. Now, there is a limit on how long that people can do that. We would expect to see some capitulation at some point where people have just put off investment decisions for a long time. Because you're seeing the economy continue to perform better than people were expecting. And at some point, that is going to enforce an investment decision, even if rates stay higher. Regulatory uncertainty. But the lending picture is not simply a question of supply and demand. The motivating slogan for bank management these days is risk-weighted asset optimization, which means in practice, the bank's balance sheet must earn a return on top of its cost of capital. In anticipation of higher capital requirements, large banks are reappraising the value of their banking relationships by this metric and adjusting to reduce their investment in the assets that do not meet it. If this is the price of sound banking, so be it. However, from a public policy perspective, when the banking industry can no longer provide all the necessary credit to the market because many businesses do not generate enough return on capital to justify the investment, the public needs to think carefully about unintended consequences. Now, there's nothing wrong with bank supervisors requiring the banking industry to hold more equity capital if holding more equity capital would prevent the next banking crisis. However, there is no clear straightforward answer as to why Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and Republic Bank failed last year, or any obvious way for bank supervisors to explain to the public why the Basel III endgame capital requirements will be the solution, not just another iteration of capital regulations that lead to Basels IV, V, and VI. These are good public policy debates, but they sit inside a political dimension where, like the Fed's monetary policy, bank supervision is another campaign slogan. For Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Chair Powell's willingness to engage in these debates is part of the problem. As she wrote to him this month, "Dear Chair Powell, big U.S. bank CEOs met with you more than a dozen times between last July and March, according to the central banker's public calendar. This is a highly disturbing turn of events. Your opposition to the Basel III rules is not new, but it now appears that you are directly doing the banking industry's bidding, rewarding them for their extensive personal lobbying of you. Taking orders from the industry that caused the 2008 economic meltdown, which sacrificed the financial security of middle class and working families to line the pockets of wealthy investors and CEOs, and further undermine public faith in the integrity of the Fed, a faith that has already declined considerably due to a series of scandals and failures under your watch." Now, the Economic Growth, Regulatory Relief, and Consumer Protection Act of 2018, better known as the CRAPO Act, rolled back some of the capital liquidity requirements required under the Dodd-Frank Act. Thus, the argument went, SVB was not subject to the Fed stress test in 2023, which presumably might have revealed that it was a financial crisis disaster waiting to happen. It should not have been exempt from capitalizing its negative accumulated other comprehensive income and its regulatory capital, which might have prevented it from taking a loss in its securities portfolio. At least, that is the argument. But bank treasurers know full well that all the equity capital in the world that SVB could have gathered would not have prevented the deposit run it suffered, that the stress test the Fed administers every year would have passed a bank such as SVB with flying colors, and there was a lot of reason to tailor capital requirements based on a bank's systemic footprint. The problem with systemic footprints is that it is not always easy for regulators to anticipate the sequence of events that would transpire to turn SVB's attempt to restructure the securities in its available-for-sale portfolio into a general call for depositors to run. SVB's tangible common equity ratio, including AOCI, was nearly 6% when it failed, which is hardly the capital profile of a bank with insufficient capital. But that is not the nuanced picture that Senator Warren painted in her letter. "The Trump-era regulatory rollbacks that you shepherded watered down the Volcker Rule, which allowed SVB to load up on risky investments, setting off its collapse and domino effect that spread to Signature and First Republic. Now, bank treasurers might tell the Senator that while the new capital rules that they expect to come out of the Basel III endgame, whenever that happens, will be manageable, the liquidity rules that bank supervisors are contemplating may be a little tougher to manage and could change some of the pricing dynamics around retail deposits. The CFO of a large regional bank in the Midwest connected his bank's buildup of reserve deposits to expectations around liquidity requirements and the Fed's balance sheet plans. Part of it is an expectation that the rules are going to get a little bit tougher. There's going to be a focus on higher runoffs on uninsured deposits. And so that is an area where we just want to make sure that we are incredibly well positioned, because we do worry about when those rules come out. Could that be a catalyst for a scramble for liquidity or an increase in deposit competition? We just want to make sure that we stay very well positioned on that front. And especially when you layer that on with some of the market mechanics that we've talked about earlier with RRP and QT, that's part of why we're staying with a lot of liquidity. It just gives us a lot of flexibility. So at some point, when the Fed does finally cut interest rates, the best of times for bank treasurers who've been sitting on a big pile of cash on which they are earning more than 300 basis points of spread will come to an end. But for now, however, the Fed is still paying bank treasurers to sit back and do nothing. Precisely what pond fishing is all about. Enjoy the vacation while it lasts.